Welcome to my Blog Talk Radio show, Live Your Music. I'm your host, Margot Joy Denader. I'm a coach, singer, songwriter, artist, and the author of The Art of Living a Life You Love. I am super happy to have Ariel Ford back as my guest. Join us for a conversation about her exciting debut novel, The Love Thief. Welcome, Ariel.
Thank you. It's really nice to reconnect with you.
I was looking back through the times that you've been on the show before, and it's been a long time since I've had you on the show. So this is really, really makes me happy to have you back today.
Thank you.
And have this exciting new novel coming out. I can't believe it. I love the cover. It's like once you see the cover, you can't forget it. It's going to definitely stand out on shelves and on Amazon and wherever else. It's really got me curious to read it.
Oh, I can't wait for you to read it.
Well, I'm glad that I was able to at least look through a pre-press proof of it and see parts of it, but I want to read the whole thing cover to cover, so I'm going to pre-order it and read it as soon as it comes out. And it comes out, what, June 27th, I believe?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you've written and published 11 nonfiction books, and this is your first novel. So I want to hear all about it. I want to hear about why you decided to write the book and about what it was like writing nonfiction compared to fiction. So,
well, writing a novel was never on my to-do list, ever. I never once in my life had the thought I should write a novel someday. And almost 5 years ago, this story started to unfold in my head like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it gave me the title and the first line in the book, and I started to see what it was about. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do this. I don't want to do this. Go away. Stop bothering me. And the story kept coming and coming, and, you know, I could see that most of the story took place in Rishikesh, India, and it was an interesting story, but I don't know how to write a novel, and I don't want to write a novel. Well, one day I got an email from masterclass.com advertising a course with Dan Brown of Da Vinci Code fame, and it was how to write a thriller. And I thought,
wow.
Oh, wouldn't it be fun to hear what Dan Brown has to say, because he's my favorite author. So I sign up for the course, and it's great. You know, he's sitting in his beautiful living room, and he's talking right into the camera, and you feel like you're the only student. And on the third episode was titled Location as a Character in the Book. And he was talking about how Florence, Italy was a character in the Da Vinci Code. And it was fascinating, and it made a lot of sense. And this light bulb in my head went off and said, oh, well, if you're going to write your book, Rishikesh, India would be a character in your book. And I started thinking about the times that I've been to Rishikesh, but I never walked the streets thinking about how I would describe it to somebody else. And I thought, well, if I were going to write this book, I would have to go back to India. And then, you know, every day I'd wake up thinking about the book, and the characters would introduce themselves to me, and it was really torture. And I said to God, I said, listen, if I'm really supposed to write this book, then I'm going to manifest a free trip to India. And I thought, I'm safe now. That is not going to happen. And 2 days later, I had a business class ticket to India in my hand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so no getting around that. That was a very clear sign. And I ended up going to India, and all the things that I saw in my head, I tripped over. Everything, the people, the places, the vistas, all of it was there. And all I had to do was take notes. So that was the start of something I didn't want to do. And then, of course, once I started, I couldn't stop, even though I wanted to stop a million times, because it's so much harder than writing nonfiction. In fact, I was telling somebody today, the only thing that writing nonfiction and fiction have in common is that they both use words.
They do, yeah.
never, ever realized how hard it is to write a novel. So I'm thrilled that it's done. It took 4.5 years. I'm happy with how the story turned out. And I'm kind of praying that this was a one-off, right? That this isn't going to happen again.
Well, I kind of get what you mean because, you know, writing my book, I only have the one book, and it wasn't my goal or my intention or desire to write a whole bunch of books or to be known as just an author because I like to do so many different things. So I get what you're saying. It's like, you know, it takes a lot even to write a nonfiction book. So and you know, it's funny when you said that, though, about never having it on your list to write a fiction book. I used to read a lot of fiction before our son was born, and when he was a baby, I remember thinking that I wanted to write a book, and I started thinking about a book that would be fiction that I would want to write, and then I thought, no, you know, I would want to write a nonfiction book before I ever got around to writing a fiction book. Yeah, and then after writing the nonfiction book, I thought, no, I don't think I need to write fiction book. So if it ever happens to me, it'll be like you going, no, I don't want to, but the story will be this.
I don't want to, and you can't make me.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, well, you know, they say what you resist persists, right? You were resisting doing it.
Yeah, that is definitely true.
Oh, my gosh. So tell us a little bit more about the book. And about,
you know, it's a story of a 38-year-old woman who has spent her entire life dreaming of having the white picket fence, you know, the husband mm-hmm. and the kids and the dog and, you know, summers at the lake and skiing in the winter. And she's been obsessed with this. And here mm-hmm. she is, nearly 38, not happening until one day she meets Prince Charming. And everything falls into place instantly. It goes so fast that, you know, she can't barely keep her balance. And they fall madly in love, and they have this very public engagement, and they're planning a wedding until Mr. Romance starts to reveal who he really is. And she ends up getting her heart broken and her dreams crushed, and he steals her money, and she gets in a car accident that nearly kills her, and she is at the bottom of the pit. Life couldn't be any worse. And she doesn't know how she's going to survive. And her auntie sends her a check for $10,000 and said that this was going to be your wedding gift, but instead I'm going to send it to you as a recreate your life gift. And I think you should go to India. Yeah, because she was a chef. And she said, my cousin has a cooking school in India. Why don't you go learn something new? Now, Holly, my heroine, has never been a seeker. Her mother's a new age baby boomer, you know, believes in the secret and everything else, hung, dream catchers over her crib, that sort of thing. So she is a total reaction to everything you and I believe in. She is not going there and doesn't even understand that where she's going, Rishikesh, India, is the yoga capital of the world because she doesn't want to do yoga. Her mother does yoga. Well, she ends up in Rishikesh, broken, you know, just healing from her car accident, heart is broken, you know, totally lost, doesn't, you know, whatever money she had, he stole from her. Things couldn't be any worse. And she ends up finding this spiritual bookstore, and the owner of the bookstore is a retired professor of counseling psychology and, of course, a deep reader of all these spiritual books. And she ends up meeting with him every morning because Rishikesh doesn't open early and she needs her caffeine fix. So he's there at 6:30 in the morning giving her a very sturdy cup of masala chai. And through this relationship with this extraordinary man, she begins to heal. She begins to understand what happened. She begins to have her own mystical, magical experiences. And along all of this, there is a revenge subplot that's very, very juicy. So by the end of the book, she has gotten revenge, and she's found happiness again. So It's got a surprise ending to it. It's a lot of fun. I have a Hollywood producer who's prepping it for a streaming series, and she says the book is Eat, Pray, Love meets Dirty John, and that is exactly what it is.
What is Dirty John?
Oh, you haven't heard about Dirty John?
No.
Dirty John, okay, so Dirty John started off as an article in the LA Times about a very attractive doctor in Newport Beach who was preying on women on the online dating apps. But it was a true story. And he ends up being killed by one of his girlfriend's daughters, and he deserved to be killed. So it started off as this article. It turned into a blog, which turned into a movie of the week, which turned into its own network, the Dirty John series of stories.
Wow.
So it's about a very attractive, Prince Charming kind of guy who is a nightmare sociopath and in the end gets it. That big time.
Oh, wow. Probably haven't heard of it because I'm up in the Bay Area and you're down in Southern California.
Oh, no, this
is
national. This was a national story and the networks are national. Why, you know what? Next time you're looking for something to stream online, type in Dirty John.
Which streaming service is it on?
Oh, I don't, you know, there's a couple of them because there's the movie of the week, there's the series.
Oh,
so, you know, you'll be able to find it.
Oh, wow. Wow, I can't believe that. But, okay, now that brings me to the fact that, okay, you're a relationship expert. So how do you see women falling for narcissists and sociopaths? What are red flags to watch for? That question makes me curious.
What happens is these men tend to be very good-looking, very charismatic, and very, very cunning. And they actually target women. It's not an accident. So if you're a smart, attractive, successful woman who's very single, you could be targeted. And what they'll do is they'll wine you and dine you and romance you and whisper in your ear everything you ever wanted to hear. And your intuitive part will be saying, oh, this seems too good to be true. That's the first red flag that you should listen to. That if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. And what happens is they keep up this act for a pretty good period of time. And then once you're hooked, once you're madly in love, that's when they allow their real self to start to appear. But by then, it's too late. You're too far gone. All you know is you're madly in love with this creature and you want him back. You know he's in there. You just spent the last 3 months, you know, with the greatest relationship of your life, and now suddenly you're with this horror show that's gaslighting you and lying to you and probably stealing your money. And it can go on for years. I had one woman who was an early reader call me and say to me, how did you know my story? You wrote this book for me. And I said, what are you talking about? Because I hadn't talked to her in a year. Well, it turns out she had been married for 10 years to a toxic narcissist who lied to her about absolutely everything in her life, including the fact that he had a whole other family on the other side of town that she knew nothing about. So she spent 10 years thinking that she was in a great marriage and everything about her life was a lie.
Wow.
So
oh
it happens.
Gosh.
It happens.
Well, you know, intuition is so important. And I remember Sonia Choquette teaching me about that and talking about how intuition is moment to moment, like what you were just saying, when you're feeling that doesn't feel like it could be true, you know, versus figuring out what's going to happen next week or
right.
next
and
year
with a narcissist, you can confront them. You could say to them, oh, well, I ran into your ex-girlfriend, your ex-neighbor, whatever, and they told me this story about you, which is probably somewhat damning. And they may not even deny it. They may say, well, it's a little exaggerated, and here's what really happened. And I apologized many times, and I am sorry that I behave that way. And they say all the correct things so that you'll let it go and forgive them. And of course, then there's the kind that lies no matter what. You know, they lie about everything all the time, and they just get louder and louder about it as they're trying to make you think you're crazy and that you didn't see what you saw and you didn't hear what you heard. So it shows up in lots of different ways.
Yeah. Wow. That's scary. It's really scary. So it's basically mostly really good-looking people or men that do it, right?
You know, I've seen all levels of it, but they tend to be very charismatic and charming,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it helps if they're good-looking, you know.
So,
but,
so not necessarily just the looks, it's that they're charismatic.
No, it's not just the looks. And they prey on women who they know are longing for love. And they know exactly what to say and how to say it and where to say it. They've, like, got a PhD in romance.
Wow. In romance, not in love.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So what message is it that you hope readers will take away from The Love Thief about having your heart broken and about being cheated on and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, there's... What I did with this book is I've spent the last dozen years being a student of love. I've interviewed
mm-hmm.
200 of the world's top love and marriage and relationship experts, and I've
wow.
learned a lot along the way, and I've tested out what I've learned. And so the best advice that I've gotten and my deepest understandings about love and what it takes to make a relationship work are woven in to the wisdom that Holly receives from the bookstore owner, you know, so it's in
mm-hmm.
there. It's like you don't actually need to repeat the past over and over again, because once you really understand what love is, you won't make the mistake a second time. And what I mean by that is that
mm-hmm.
most people that think love is a feeling, and they think that when you're in the state of being in love, that that is love, but it is
mm-hmm.
absolutely not love. Being in love is a socially acceptable form of insanity, and it's nature's trick to get us to procreate, because when you're in the state of being in love, you're in that state with a stranger. You don't know anything about them. You just know how good it feels. It's nature's greatest drug high, but it has nothing
yeah.
to do with love.
Uh-huh.
So real mature adult love
uh-huh.
has some wonderful feelings to it. But ultimately, love is a behavior. Love is a behavior.
Yeah.
It's a choice. It's a decision. It's an action. It's a way of being. And the feelings come and go. So as most people who are married understand, is that you can love your spouse, and there will be days when you hate them, and it doesn't mean that you don't love them.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go all the way to hate, but definitely there are moments where you're going, oh, my God, why are you behaving that way, or why did you say that, or can't you say that this way, or whatever, you know, to each other, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah. Dudley and I are at 40 years we've been married, so it's, you know, I know what you're saying is definitely true. And it
yeah,
is a feeling,
it's a daily
but it's
choice.
Not just a feeling. It's love. Oh, that brings me to the, also, you said the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love, is a big lie. What do you mean by that?
Yes, All You Need Is Love is a big fat lie, and it's the soundtrack of all of our love lives. All you need is love. No,
yeah.
love is not enough to make a marriage work. It just absolutely
yeah.
isn't. And they have research on this. This isn't just me talking. This is science. And
right.
what they have discovered is that in order to have a happy, healthy, long-term marriage, there are certain elements that must be present. And
uh-huh.
they are connection, compatibility, communication, which, thank God, can be learned,
yeah.
chemistry. And chemistry is the least important of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important is a shared vision for the future. You want the same big, basic things in life. You both want to live together in the same house, if that's
mm-hmm.
what you want. Or you
mm-hmm.
both want to live separately and just be together a couple times a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
You both want children, or you both don't want children. You both want to live in the mountains, or you both want to live at the beach. You know, you don't have to do everything together and probably shouldn't, but the shared vision for the future is, you know, we are going to have, you know, an open, honest, fun, interesting life together that involves, you know, music and poetry and picnics, whatever it is for you. And then when you have
I love
shared,
that.
Yeah, so the shared vision is really critical, you know, and it's even harder to do these days because 10 years ago, a Democrat could be married to a Republican and it would be okay, right?
Yeah.
Now, before you leave your house, before you leave your house on a first date, you need to know where they are politically because it's just not possible anymore given how polarized it is. Because you could, I had one friend who got married 3 years ago, and she's, you know, very blue, liberal, but not politically involved person, married to a Fox News-watching Trump supporter.
Oh, my God.
And when I asked her about it before the wedding, oh, I'm not interested in politics. I don't really care. It's not a problem. And then the pandemic hit, and all his other anti-vaxxer, you know, all interesting, you know, let's go down the rabbit hole kind of stuff came up, and they got divorced. So a shared vision for the future is really important, even if you're not politically active. You know, you could you could get into World War III just discussing what's happening on the southern border, you know, because you could have a lot of empathy for the starving children that are at the border. Or you could be all in favor of, let's put those babies in little jail cells and rip them out of the arms of their mother. You don't want to have that conversation after you've had sex with them. You want to know before you leave the house that you're at least of similar like mind when it comes to today's big issues, which are bigger than ever.
Right. Well, you know, Wayne Dyer always said not to label yourself and other people, and that's so true. I mean, I hate having labels put on me, and I've never been somebody who wanted to be just a Democrat or just a Republican or whatever. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be labeled that. I wanted to look for what I felt was right. And somehow there's some, I hate to say it, but there's some people I know that were, they go, well, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, so I only vote for those people.
Right, but now one-third of the country is independent, so that's no longer true. You know, but even if you're not labeling yourself red or blue or purple,
right?
You still have, you want to have shared values.
Oh,
right?
I totally agree.
Right, and whether or not somebody has empathy for humanity, you know, you want to have a shared value. What do you think about women's right to choose? Probably needs to be a shared value, especially if you're going to have children and you're going to have a teenage daughter. You know, and she gets pregnant. Are you going to give her a morning after pill, or are you going to, you know, send her away like in our generation where you got sent away to be with the nuns until they ripped the baby out of you and put it up for adoption? So, you know, so there, you can no longer live with your head in the sand. Even if you don't like world events, you're a part of it now. There's no avoiding it.
Oh, we are all. You're so right. You know, we've only got 6 minutes left, though, and so much more to cover.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, I know. Time goes so fast once the show gets started. But I'm curious what you have to say about this one, too. Why do you believe happiness is the wrong goal for us to have? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
So I spent a lot of years, before I was a student of love, I was a student of happiness because I grew up a very depressed child and young adult, and I wanted to be happy. So I started to study happy people. And then over the last decade or so, I learned something that changed my point of view entirely, because what's true about happiness is that happiness is contingent on people, places, things, and experiences. So if you're, you know, if you're wanting to have a relationship and you find one, you're happy, you have the relationship, and then you start to have struggles. Now you're unhappy with the relationship. What I discovered is beyond happiness is a word called santosha. Santosha.
What is it
and
called?
It's Sanskrit, santosha, S-A-N-T-O-S-H-A, santosha. And it's Sanskrit for utter contentment. And when you're in the state of Santosha, you are content. You are at peace, regardless of the people, places, things, and experiences around you. So evolutionary, that's sort of the higher state to get to. So mm-hmm. that's what I strive for. Yes, of course, I want to be happy. And yes, I do things that I think will make me happy. But I know mm-hmm. that ultimately cultivating Santosha is, for me, the best place to go.
I like that. Santosha. I learned something
yeah.
new.
And that's one of the main themes of The Love Thief also is, you know, really starting to understand, you know, what it is you're putting your attention on and what you're striving for. You know, another one is that so many people expect their partner, their spouse, to make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is we are all personally responsible for our own happiness. And if you're with a good partner, well, that's icing on the cake. But it's
right.
not their job to make you happy.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that. That is so important to realize that we're each responsible for our own happiness. Oh, my gosh. I wish we had another hour to talk, but we don't. So,
well, you know,
one
thing I wanted to mm-hmm. tell everybody about is that mm-hmm. if you go to the website, thelovethief.com, and you're
mm-hmm.
interested in the book, you can pre-order the book. And there's this huge bonus. I put together this video series of the world's top yoga teachers, each giving yoga philosophy and yoga poses on how to overcome negative emotions. So there's one on betrayal, one on grief, one on heartache, depression, uncertainty, forgiveness, betrayal. Right? So if you're suffering
wow.
from any of those, you can instantly get these free videos that are going to shift you emotionally and physically into a lighter, brighter state.
I love that. I also love the idea of pre-ordering it too, though, which I'm going to do for sure, because of the fact that that way it'll just arrive when it's supposed to arrive. I don't have to try and remember when is it going to be out, you know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Oh, Arielle, I'm so glad that I asked you to be back on the show today. I'm so glad.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you've written this fiction book because, you know, there's so many, when I read fiction books, a lot of times I'm going, you know, I love learning from other people's experiences. Whether they're totally real people or not doesn't matter as much as it does how it resonates with my heart, you know. And so many people need to be happier these days, that's for sure, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, these are very difficult times. So, you know, one of the things that I managed to do in the book is really weave together the best and the deepest life lessons I've acquired over my 70 years on the planet into
uh-huh.
a very digestible story. Where, you know, you can fall in love with this heroine who's having a horrible time and watch her transformation, watch her growth in a way that's not preachy or giving you assignments, you know.
Right.
It's,
and there's a lot of people who won't read nonfiction anyway. And so I also am thrilled that it's going to be a series.
Yeah,
watch
me too.
As well, because,
yeah, unfortunately,
oh
with the writer's strike on, I have no idea when this is going to happen. It may be a while, but you know, eventually
it'll happen
when it's
meant to happen. You know,
exactly.
That's the thing. My brother and I are always reminding ourselves that everything happens in divine timing, and there's a lot of things that have to happen to make it happen. But it'll happen when it's meant to be, and it's something to look forward to.
I agree.
All right. In the last minute we have left, what do you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, you know, I think the most important message I have for anybody is that there's no shortage of love in the world, especially
mm-hmm.
single people. They're running around mm-hmm. like, you know, there's not enough love because, like, they don't know how it's going to come to them. They're just like, oh, I have a love deficit. And the truth is there's no shortage of love in the world. And one of the ways you can really build yourself up is to do a daily love gratitude process, which all it involves is closing your eyes, going from your head to your heart, and inside of your heart, send a wave of love to every person in your life, whether it's your parents, your kids, your siblings, your best friends, your coworkers, your dogs, your cats, and just allow your own heart to feel the abundance of all the love you already have. And when you do that, then you make your heart magnetic to pulling in romantic love.
Oh, I love that. Well, we're going to be cut off soon, so we need to get going. But thank you, thank you, thank you for all of the ways you're living your music, Arielle.
Oh, thank you. It was great talking with you.
It was great talking with you as well. Bye for now. Talk to you later.